Thank you all for some really interesting and thought-provoking presentations. We have some time now for discussion, thoughts, questions for any of the presenters. Please.
So I teach a class called Community Program Planning, but it's based around service learning, community-based projects for graduate students. Now there's intense curriculum content with just giving them the tools to get the projects done. How do you balance, I'm curious about how much time different classes have in the classroom and how you balance that tension between needing them to have some exposure to key concepts, but also needing to have the skills to do a good job on a very specific project.
I bet you're doing a great job with that, and you're just asking that question. I know you do a good job with that. That's a really big challenge. I think I sort of mentioned it a little bit. Our class is a 2.5-hour, once a week class. And because of the challenges of students living all over the place, I really feel it's important to give them time in class to work together on these projects. So sometimes that eats up a lot of time. I create a syllabus, and I have topics I need to cover, and readings that they read, and I think they're keeping up with the readings, and I don't think I have actually an answer, just one approach, and that's to kind of stay the course. For the first few weeks, we really do a lot of introduction stuff to doing CBPR, and it's not a program planning course, so I don't actually have all of the other elements. A program planning course has a lot of content in it. This is more of an assessment course, and so I think the readings explain a lot. I give them tools like the Community Toolbox, which is a website. I don't know if anybody's ever used it. It's at the University of Kansas or whatever. And there's a lot of great tools on there that you can just get in a pinch, and I think that reviewing that, they learned some things too. I also check in to see with them what other content we need to be talking about. But I'm not the only one in the room to have an answer for that. I think that's a really interesting and challenging question. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
One thing, and again, this is do you call it service learning? Do you call it internship or practicum? And one of the things that I was trying to do was just raise awareness of the meaning of these terms as you move on the continuum from, undergraduate liberal arts education into the, master's or PhD level. So a lot of internships must have a 6-credit design in order to have course content delivery in the skill sets and the theoretical frameworks, because, part of what I share with, Nancy and the Spirit of 1848 work is that your frameworks matter, the way you ask the questions matter. And, one of the things that I hope I conveyed is that when I talk about research, this is one of the things that I tell my students who say, oh no, I will never do research, I hate research, is wait till you learn from me what research really is and the methods that are part of participatory and inclusive research. Not just CBPR, but I'm a big fan of Wandersman's Getting to Outcomes. I really like, and I think it's very much in keeping with what you presented, which is that we don't decide ahead of time what methods we're going to use. We decide that in as part of the partnership and as part of what these emergent research questions are. But I think that's really the solution. And for me, I hate to even say that because one of the things Campus Community Partnerships for Health has been looking at a lot, and people who do service learning in whatever format, is the fact that universities don't really reward that. That's typically not something you can publish. It's typically not going into anything but your service side of your ledger. And so one of the things that I learned is, because I proposed a health promotion internship to solve the problem, that we had with our student mentoring that they didn't have enough time, that one semester wasn't enough, that 3 credits wasn't enough. And I discovered that if you do an internship, we have an internship, credit bearing opportunity in quite a few of our majors, where you can do a seminar plus a placement in some skill area. I discovered that you teach a 6-credit course and you get credit for 3 credits only. And all the work you do for designing placements and supervising placements, you don't get credit for. And that's why in my department, the only people teaching them are part-timers. And in applied sociology, where they have a wonderful internship, the person teaching it is a saint. That is, she's a feminist, long committed to the education of working class students, because otherwise, I teach in a university with a 3-3 credit, a 3-3 load, and I don't get any credit for supervising my PhD students, except in a course load reduction. So it's this idea of workload in the universities that do the most to educate diverse urban students. It's just, a fact of life in the U.S. till the revolution comes.
Is this related to the comment, or anyone else have any thoughts on the question of balancing content and experience, getting that information out there? I know this was kind of a very small tricky thing that we did was to, you can designate courses as a certain number of credits, lecture and lab. And so like for the program planning class that I've taught, we make it 2 credits lecture, 1 credit lab, because the lab hours are twice the lecture hours, and so you just get more time that way. It does a little bit toward your question, but I've had that same thing of you're wanting the students to have the experience, and you're wanting them to also read and integrate and think about these topics that are so much more than the one experience that's in the classroom. Anyone have any other thoughts about solutions to that? Okay, let's move on to your question, please.
My name is Gail Gordon. I'm with New Jersey City University. We are also an urban institution, and we have many challenges. We have a 4-4. We do get released time for the chair. I'm the chair. We rotate the chair. I'm the chair at this point. Depending on color, here is going to be single, which is ridiculous. But anyway, so we. Our challenges are very heavy teaching roles, administrative responsibilities, and I don't want to seem like I'm whining, because I want to move on to but I just want to set this in the scene. Our students are extremely diverse, and that is just a real strength of our program. But we also have incredible diverse skill sets of our students. Most of our students come from Hudson County, New Jersey, and they range from practically illiterate. I mean, they get from social promotions to just a very good student. So we have that challenge as well. We are in the process now of looking at what we're teaching and how we're teaching it. And this is really, I mean, so much of what you said has really resonated with us and with what we're trying to do with changes. One thing I wanted to raise is that because we also have we have day students and night students, and never the twain shall meet. And they also are the single moms, and the story that I tell about sort of the most extreme circumstances of a student who has 3 jobs and to get his child back from custody and going to school full time. And working, and so just trying to get they're required to do an internship. But we do it like student learning in our classes as much as we can, and we try to use the university as a community and do things during class time. For example, the food service. We also then got into food service employee income and the living wage. And then compare the food on the truck on the street to the food service, et cetera. So, and then we looked at the cleanliness of the restroom facilities and the soap and where is that being done. And so there are things I think that people can think of on campus, and we really have a long way to go in terms of this, because I do think this is the way it goes. Service learning and participatory, because that is what our students, I believe, respond most to. And we're still not there. But
Thank you so much for your question and comment. And so what I heard you talking about is this wide range of student experiences coming into the room and working around that, which I think, Jean, you mentioned that, and also these heavy teaching loads. And it sounds like you've come up with some very creative solutions for getting student experiences in the moment, so to speak, with the class, with the university as a community, doing those types of things. Do either of you have other comments or thoughts about this?
I have the same exact teaching load. I hear exactly what you're saying. We have a 4-4. And I think part of why I wanted to do service learning was because of my frustration of not feeling like I had enough time to do service and scholarship because I was teaching so much. But I, you know, it is challenging. I want to try to do service learning in our undergraduate class, which a lot of our students have a lot more of the conditions that you just raised, and I think that will be very, very interesting. They just need a lot more guidance, I guess, and really, again, I think it's that if they can pick their skill and pick, and you have those working groups that work with the skills that they have, because if they're not good writers, they maybe they're, they're fantastic people, public, you know, either public speaking or they're great to walk into an agency, they have great personalities, they just, you know, they, what I know about our undergrads is that they have the answers to these, a lot of these social problems because they've lived it and they see what needs to happen. And so I'm excited to try this with them to kind of get some more of the solution ideas out of that too. I'm not sure why, I don't know if that's helpful at all, but.
Well, I wanted to add that one of the reasons why I like Unnatural Causes is an introduction, you know, to the value of research in health disparities. It's part of Paulo Freire's participatory pedagogy that you want people to become aware and become outraged by the consequences of social inequality in their own lives and the lives of other people. And I make their analysis of their educational experiences as it compares to that of other students in the classroom part of the work. And also that if you've come from a poverty background, you probably do not have the skills you need for college work. And that that's one of the unfairnesses of what happens in our society, that you have a responsibility to redress, first of all, by getting the skills you need, because if you're illiterate, you cannot help anybody, including yourself. And, you know, I put in front of the students the data, you know, loud and clear about what it means. It's not just being enrolled in college. Until you graduate from college, you don't have the health benefits of college education in terms of income and health. So our university offers a lot of very good student support programs. We happen to be the place where a lot of Paulo Freire's work was translated into educational work. And actually, I just learned recently that Nina Wallerstein did her first book with one of our faculty who works in adult education. So I do think this idea that there's a step of awareness raising and then that you use that motivation for students to do the remedial work they will have to do through other supports on the campus. Through some of the work that I'm doing with both students and community members, we're looking at peer navigator community health worker models for helping students partner with other students to think about what they need to do to survive and thrive in the college environment. Because for our students, it's not just the educational issues, it's all of these other life experience and life events burdens, and I'm hoping to make some progress on that. It's hard to get any institution to do anything new, so it's a work in progress. Oh, Janita.
I don't know if this quite answers your question, and I think Esther actually does an excellent job of working with the student. But what we did. It was actually my rather first experience of working with urban college students. So what I did was I spent some time, and it's time consuming, I mean, I don't think there's any way to get out of that, but I think if you're committed and want to do the mentoring, and now you're looking at the end goal, you just have to take the time. And so you as an employee, you know, who's giving the student the internship, you know, realizes this. But one of the things I did was actually to talk with the student, tell them what I wanted, and find out where their skill level is. So now again, this is not so much to my advantage, more to their advantage. And so try and set the internship up, or it's turning to service learning, up at their level, so that I do get some of the things I need, but at the same time, it becomes a learning experience for them. The other thing is, it does require a lot of work. So you're constantly meeting with the student, getting feedback, you know, and constantly highlighting. So for example, if you're doing a literature review, do you know what a literature review is? Here is information on a literature review. This is how you set it up. You go through that. So what are you going to do? This is what I suggest you can do. Okay, you go think what you're going to do. They come back again, you know, and then you go through that. You know, you do the literature review. You read with the student. And in this particular case, the student did her review. And I said, okay, what does this mean? And she said, I said, well, this is what a literature review is. You are to read the information and summarize it. And you have to summarize it in your own words. So if you can't say what it is, then how do you know in the end what you're going to write on? You know, so it is a lot of work. And I think it's only for people who are committed to moving your urban college students, because at the end, you see the great results. I mean, Esther will say, we ended up with a student who was very excited and thinking about going to graduate school. You know, we had to work around schedules, again, as you're all aware. So we had a student who had great skills in an area we used her, but unfortunately she was dealing with credit, she was dealing with health issues, she was dealing with work. And so I don't really know that there's a way around it. I think maybe the advantage in our case is that we had the internship, but Esther was also providing other learning experiences and educational information for the student. But I think being that we had the internship at Harvard, maybe lessened the relationship for us. But there's no way around it. I think it's just a lot of work, and you have to be committed. And end results, as you see, as Esther noted, one of the interns is on our Community Research Advisory Board. She's taken what she learned in her internship, what she learned in Esther's classes, and she's a very active part of our community research. But there's no way out of it. It's a lot of work, but rewarding.
Well, one of the solutions to, and I think Special, you know, is here as part of the solution, is that students that have been there are very committed to working with the coming up generation. And so having intergenerational research teams where, you know, frankly, neither Janita or I, you know, and Brian, we talked about this at the end of that semester, we cannot afford this much time on mentorship, but we will not get our projects done. So that question of how do you create a community in which people take responsibility for each other, and that's why I want to go to peer models. Working class students actually are very intimidated by faculty. They think we're like another species. I mean, I remember, I come from an immigrant family that thought that if I got an education, nobody would marry me. And I remember looking at my college professors with great curiosity. I mean, how do you put together a life based on the creation of knowledge? I just didn't know how that worked. And I do think that it's very important to create an atmosphere in which everybody is contributing to the generation of knowledge and appreciates that it's a team effort. And I think that helps too.
I attend, I'm a doctoral student, and I'm at the very non-prestigious University of North Carolina, Greensboro. And so we're right there with a couple of prestigious schools. But anyways, I don't know if it's just unique to our school or not, but we've got an Office of Leadership and Service Learning. And they're really cool because they offer support to faculty and to students. They maintain the community connections and a log of them. So if you have a student that's just interested in service learning but you can't incorporate it into the class, they can go there and actually do an independent study. Also, they do a grant funding a cycle every year in the fall, and they give, this year was $3,000 per team, and it includes an undergrad research and a graduate student researcher, and so the grad student acts as a mentor to the undergrad, and that's a way to get undergrads interested in research right away. And so they look for transdisciplinary teams, and it has to be undergrad, grad student, and faculty sponsorship of that.
Yeah, that's a highly recommended strategy. That's really a great idea. Is Greensboro a residential or a commuter campus?
You know, I'm not sure I know the difference.
Do your students live in dorms or do they commute?
Most of our students commute, I would imagine.
Okay, all right, because that, yeah, that, then that's just, you know, when you have a residential campus, then the students, there's a kind of like a town gown split, and there's a little bit of this feeling of people going into, you know, the community urban setting to learn things they can't learn on campus, which is very different from the spaces where the students come from the community and go back to the community. Yeah, we have a service learning, a leadership and service learning office. It's a new office with new reconfiguration that I think is going to be more promising, because with the previous director, I kept fighting with her because I would always create my programs for whatever, gender-based violence, where I would bring somebody in to do a talk, and then I would bring people in who would talk about jobs you can take, because that's one of the things that I talked to students about right away, is elevating your employment so that it has more to do with your professional portfolio. So if you're working at the Y, at the door, go talk to the Y about your interests and are there any programs there. You know, so students can get hired to do a lot of things that are more relevant if you're going to take a job doing, you know, counseling in a hospital or in a respite institution. Go someplace that does research. Talk to people so that at least you see some roles that you can aspire to. We have a new office, and I think it's more serious about the scholarship and the reflection that we need to do across the curriculum, so that there are people in education policy that are looking at our strategic planning for that office. And I'm making an argument that we have to have a really strong research component in order for us to be the kind of urban university we aspire to be, as Keith Motley says, a research university with a teaching heart.
Thank you for bringing that idea of looking to other resources on campus like that to assist with developing these kinds of courses and experiences. Any other questions out there? I have one other question for the speakers, if there's nothing else out here. I think there, the topic of the challenge of time or connection with the community-based organizations is an interesting one. And so I'd like to see if you guys have figured out ways of, you know, like it's great to have the students brainstorm and figure out how to connect, but sometimes these organizations are busy, and so how do you keep them engaged and involved in this process along the way? Either of you have comments on that?
I think I'm still learning the process and how that will work. I think a couple of things, obviously, is to constantly be in touch with them via email, but we've also tried to get another sort of a champion in the agency, so we have another contact person, because we're working with the health department in Bridgeport, and the director just went to South Africa for a couple of weeks, and we're trying to set up a focus group, so, which he gave us her assistance name, and we want to move that. I also think I've had them go on site, just show up, you know, sometimes you just have to kind of show up and be there, and then you can get their attention. But that, I haven't figured the whole thing out yet. It's kind of a work in progress.
Well, because my agenda is so much bridging the gap between research and careers that urban students can see themselves in, I tend to think about partnerships where the community organizations already have some sort of research-friendly environment, or it's really a program evaluation research agenda. There's a lot of funding in our state that's linked to tracking outcomes. And so that's one of the things that I do, is that I think carefully about where I place students. My way of working is that I have the students develop a portfolio project. Often those are individual, because I'm really thinking about who they are, what their job experiences are, and then how to place them. I think placing people on campus is a very, very important resource, and kind of thinking about who your community is on the campus. And then also, you know, but because our non-traditional students are community members. But I think I feel terrible, you know, Janita, I'm just reminded how hard you worked. in the mentoring of those students and the challenge that I know how overextended our community-based organizations are, and that you don't want them to be burdened by an additional burden when they're already overextended staff. So the solution is that you end up putting in a lot of time to fill in those gaps, those skill gaps, and the product gaps. And I don't know that there's a better answer than that, but you do want the community organization to get some of the benefits of why they signed up to use students in the first place.
Any other thoughts of an audience you've done that have worked with this? And did you have
a thought?
Thank you. I'm sorry.
This, I don't know how it works here. I'm from New Zealand. So this has been a really interesting session to hear. But I was just in some of the, and I guess it's the way, in fact, students come to be students in university. But one of the things that we've been looking at, and I work in a university, but is actually using community, you know, where community groups, where they may not yet have the, they want to be involved in research, they see the value of, in very practical terms, in keeping stats, doing data, improving their services and all of that. And I work with quite a few Indigenous, that is Māori, provider services in New Zealand. And what we actually have, I guess, gone backwards, maybe, I don't know how you would frame it. So we've talked with the community, with the service providers in the community, within the service, and asked them to identify people within the service who are interested in research, and we brought them into universities. I mean, it's not, I know it's not a way that, you know, students are coming to you wanting to learn and do all of that, but we do that as well, obviously, but actually in engaging with the particular services and communities and health providers in their own environments. And they're very much, because of those things, because of the, you know, the stretch on resources for them, but very much still wanting these particular research skills within their organisations, but not having the specific resources to do it. So that's a way that we're trying to bring that in.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great idea of another way of looking at bringing people together. That sounds really effective. Thank you. So, let me know if I get this summary. She was talking about kind of an alternative way is looking out into the service providers and the community groups and finding out who there is interested in research and interested in engaging and kind of coming at it that way.
I wanted to add two things about the New Zealand context, you know, because I use the Commonwealth, UK, Australia, New Zealand, Canada as counterexamples to what happens in the US when I teach. So one of the things you have when you have the human right to health, as you do in other countries and do not have in the US, is that it's a shared social desire to spend your money wisely. And so evidence-based practice or practice-based research becomes part of a national conversation. There isn't this idea that providers are entitled to do whatever they please, and you know, maybe you have gold standard research and maybe you don't, you know, from a biomedical standpoint, but that models of knowledge generation with community-based groups, I think, are far more advanced. I know that I use a lot of evidence-based practice resources from New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and UK just because they have a lot of resources for practitioners to make them very accessible. So I think that part of what we're facing is some of the inequalities that are part of the US health system to begin with, that then have consequences that trickle down in some of the spaces where we're trying to work and bridge. But a lot of what I have to do is to also train not just students, but community practitioners about the benefits of a different way of thinking about research. Yesterday at the Community Health Workers SPIG, there was this great presentation on a participatory process for generating a database for tracking outcomes that a community group needed for their grant, and that University of Michigan and a team of people working community health worker type of models generated. The thing was beautiful. I mean, I was trying to figure, we were all trying to figure out, is it proprietary? Will you come teach us this process? Because they ended up with something that the community health worker and practitioner community wanted to use. Mm-hmm. So I think inclusive methods have to be a part of the research conversation. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. And I see we're just a little bit over time. So please join me in thanking Jean, Esther, and Special.